Hello, welcome to another episode of Everything is Canon, the Cinelinks podcast. I'm your host, Steve Duncan. However you may have found your way here, thanks so much for tuning in. On this podcast, we invite authors from all genres onto the show to discuss their latest books and novels, as well as just about anything else that comes to mind. If you want to reach me, there are several ways to do so, but the easiest is to email me at steve@cinelinks.com, or you can always find me on Twitter at stevedunk5 or at everythingcanon. Today on the show, we're talking to author Alexander Freed and Delray creative director Elizabeth Schaefer all about the just-released Star Wars Victory's Price, the final book in the Alphabet Squadron trilogy. Having been with this series from the very beginning and making it known that it's my favorite Star Wars trilogy of all time, I had to have both Alex and Elizabeth back on the show for one last Alphabet Squadron mini roundtable. My full non-spoiler review is up at Cinelinks, but know that what I think what Alex has done with this series is nothing short of genius, and I hope everyone gets a chance to take it all in. The three of us talk about all sorts of things related to this book and the series as a whole, including how the both of them are feeling now that it's all over. Warning, while this is definitely a spoiler-free discussion, the odd minor detail may slip out. So, if you haven't read the book and don't wish to be spoiled at all, better stop listening now, but definitely double back once you've read the book. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. As always on this podcast, we encourage supporting authors and stories that affirm the lives of people other than ourselves. Each time we either engage in a conversation, whether it be online or face-to-face, if we ever do that again, or each time we participate in the market. And it's important that we do that all year long. Okay, today is a special show because it's both a celebration and a memorial service for what I have publicly declared to be the greatest trilogy in the history of Star Wars publishing. And yes, that includes the Expanded Universe as well. And yes, I understand that's a bold statement, but I said what I said. I'm referring, of course, to the Alphabet Squadron trilogy, whose final book, Victory's Price, came out last week and is woefully undersummarized as the aces of the New Republic have one final chance to defeat the darkness of Shadowing in this thrilling conclusion to the Star Wars Alphabet Squadron trilogy. In my review, I said, what Alexander has done here is go beyond simple battles of good versus evil, of light versus dark. More than almost any other, what he's offering is a decisively more morally complex view of not only the universe, but also the majority of the people who occupy it. And in doing so has created a majestically nuanced version of Star Wars that is more textured, complicated, beautiful, violent, and rich. And he did it without using superlatives or ideas and concepts that have been laundered to death. I really think this is as original a Star Wars story as you're likely to get nowadays in that part of the timeline. I'm pleased as punch to once again be joined by both the trilogy's mad architect and his arbiter. Welcome back, author Alexander Freed and Delray's creative director and the editor of this trilogy, Elizabeth Schaefer. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hi. And yeah, thank you for that very kind introduction.
Well, I teased you the other day on Twitter, Alex, my review so far is 4,000 words.
Oh my gosh.
I think my Shadowfall one was longer than that, but I'd have to go back and look. But
I feel like if I was allowed to overwrite the books, you're allowed to overwrite the review.
I can't help it, man. I just keep going. I can't stop writing about this book. Alex, you probably wouldn't have noticed this too, but I sort of like, you know, because I read and review and all different types of books, not just Star Wars. For the first time since the last time I can remember, a Star Wars book ended up in my top 20 from last year, and that was Shadowfall. So I just think that book is so, so great. And I'm in love with it. And I'm happy to say that this book, I think, maintains that high level. It's been a long journey. I'm going to miss you guys. But listen, all good things must come.
I'm heading out into the West now.
But all good things come to an end. I was, you know, of course you reminisce, right, when things end. And I was thinking, you know, the very first time I heard about this story, Michael Seguin, the great Michael Seguin, told me, I think it was at, this is a, it is a few years ago, at least, obviously, and we were talking about books at some convention, and he said, "Oh, well, wait till you see Alphabet Squadron. Wait till you see this. Let me tell you about this." And hadn't even heard of it before, and it was long before it had come out, obviously. And I was like, "Okay, sounds pretty good." And here we are now, years later,
at the end of all things.
If we could borrow a line. So obviously, though, to myself and, you know, most, you know, 90 something percentile of the people out there, this Victory's Price will be new to, you know, when they pick it up and read it, right? But for the both of you, you've known about the specifics of this for so long now, obviously, just in a general sense, you know, all that's, you know, the only thing left is the public's reaction. So I'm just wondering how both of you are feeling now that this is over. You both have worked so closely, you know, on these books together, and now that we're at the end, how you both feeling about it? Start with Alex.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about this the other day, and one of the nice, I guess, things about publishing is that nothing sort of happens suddenly, right? There's a tapering off of everything. So I've had time to adjust to the fact that these characters are no longer in my life, right? You finish the first draft, you send it off, you know, you've got a few weeks away, it starts to hit you that, oh yeah, I'm done. But then it comes back and you've got revisions and edits, and then you've, you know, got another little time away from it, and then you're reviewing the proofs. And every time you're interacting with the text a little bit less, right? Every time, you know, you're less artistically engaged with what's there because more of it is finished. Mm-hmm. But there's never like a moment of, okay, this is clearly when it's done. And so I've adjusted to being without all this. I'm not in mourning. I think partly because
just me and Elizabeth. Elizabeth, you're in mourning. I know you're in mourning, Elizabeth.
Oh my gosh, absolutely. Although it's funny you say about all that's left is to wait for the audience response, and I feel like this is one of the few books I'm always so nervous the day before a book lands, and just, Did we accomplish what we were trying to do? Is this going to connect at all? And I do not have that worry with Victory's Price at all. I don't know if that's hubris, just saying, well, yeah, everyone's going to love it, or if it's also just the immense personal satisfaction that I have from this book, that it almost doesn't matter what other people think. I got to have this book, and that is enough. That is more than enough for me.
Well, that was one of the things I was going to ask you later on, Elizabeth, but might as well get to it now. So, because I know you're such a huge fan of Alex's writing and this series specifically and these characters. So you're not just the editor and the creative director, but you're also a huge fan of this particular series. How were you, you know, if you can remember back to when maybe you got the first draft of Victory's Price, the first time you read through it, you know, how you felt reading through it. Obviously you would have known, you've had the outlines and the general idea the whole time, but reading the first draft of the final book, how was that for you?
Oh my gosh. Well, you know, that was, I think, 84 years ago when that happened. We were all in a very different place in the world.
Yes.
I want to say I was in California when it came in. Yeah, at some meetings at Disney. And yeah, it is, it's easy to look back on something you love and kind of read into like, oh yes, and I fully understood at that moment how important everything was, blah, blah, blah. But it really was a special moment opening up that manuscript for the first time and meeting Erica Coyle, meeting Chess, meeting Will, meeting Nath and Kairos, and who are all my disaster children now. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you just know something's going to be brilliant, and that was one of these cases.
And the ending sort of left you feeling very satisfied or
bereft, heartbroken, empty inside, but yet so full. I told Alex when I was had just finished it and was trying to type up notes and really struggling just because it you know, I don't get very personally emotional often on manuscripts, but I certainly did in this case.
Right.
But I was so lucky to have my team, Tom Holler and Alex Davis. We all read it together and then just hopped on a call for 2.5 hours afterward, not making editorial notes, just talking about the book because we had all loved it so much.
One of the things I was just back, Alex, to you were talking about, you know, things sort of ending and all this stuff, but I just read this great book. It's called The Electric Kingdom anyways by David Arnold. And one of the ideas he sort of looks at in that book is how humans create immortality through art. And just, you know, thinking about these books are just around now forever. It's never going to go away. You understand that, right? You'll be signing copies of these books for years to come, right?
Be hurting people for generations.
Yes. Is that, do you think about that at all ever when you're, and this could be for any of the books you've written for, whether it's Star Wars or not, right?
I mean, it's maybe not generations, but it's certainly something that, you know, you think about, okay, how long are these things going to be out there, and how long are they going to have to have an effect on people, and you know, how far down will that effect trickle? You know, and actually with the sort of the franchise stuff, right? It's actually probably much more likely that, you know, this Star Wars novel will be accessible and available in 30 years than, you know, any random video game or, you know, an original book that I wrote, right? Like, stuff has a way of disappearing, but the weight of the Star Wars name keeps things alive to a certain extent, which is gratifying. I mean, it's nice to think that this stuff will be available to people for a while to come.
Yeah, and I think part of that is, I mean, I don't know about, I know, I'm sure you guys are similar, like you have books that you love that you reread every once in a while that have, you know, came out decades ago, right? I mean, there's, and we'll just keep it in Star Wars, there's EU books I go back and read all the time.
Yeah, I mean, I...
Just to that, just, you know what I mean? Like, there's, like, you know, there's just no way I'm at some point I'm going to go back, I'm going to sit down, and now that this is done, I'm going to sit down and read all three books. Like, I'm going to, you know what I mean? So...
It is, yeah, nice, I, that... Oh, sorry, go ahead. Wow.
No,
I'll just say that it's so nice that these characters, even though we said goodbye to them in finishing this trilogy, that the story is always has happened, will happen, happening, happened, and you can go right back to it and relive it all over.
It's just a weird decision though he made to like kill absolutely every character in the book at the end. I don't know. Like, that was kind of,
I couldn't bear the thought of anyone else writing them.
You're, I mean, evil.
I mean, we all love Rogue One, but I mean, come on, you didn't have to copy the ending. I mean, that was exactly the same ending, Alex. You could have come up with something. But anyways, so again, we'll just do a little sort of go back in time a little bit when you first sat down and the outlining process was going on. Did everything sort of go according to plan then, now that it's all said and done? Or was there any sort of anything, major changes in the story, the direction of the story at all? Or is this sort of like, you know, Elizabeth going back to the outlining days, is this sort of like, yeah, this is kind of what, and I know he's notorious for, you know, insanely detailed, yeah, and long and specific outlines.
I think most of the major beats are pretty similar. I would love to hear Alex's impression of this. I think, yeah, they're pretty similar. I think I will say in a non-spoilerly way that the deaths is something we probably, that went back and forth the most, mm-hmm, about exactly how certain things should happen. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Alex, do you feel like things evolved a lot?
Yeah, I mean, I, a month or two back, just out of curiosity, I pulled up, I don't know if you remember, I, you know, after we agreed that we were going to do this thing, I sent you maybe a 3-page document of, okay, here are characters, and here's like, you know, 2 or 3 paragraphs for each book, and this is the plan for the next couple of years, and here's what I expect it to come together. And yeah, it's pretty much that. You know, there definitely were specific character fates that changed along the way, but the overall arc, the themes, and certainly the spine of it all feels like it was pretty much as planned.
Yeah, because like in a one and done, it's one thing, but 3 books, that's a long time, right? That's years. You know what, yeah, I mean? And so much can happen in our own lives, and so much can change in Star Wars, and what, I mean, who knows what can happen and change, right? In 3-4 years.
Yeah, absolutely. I did not want to work without a roadmap of some sort. I didn't want to try to figure out, okay, book one, now where do things go in book two?
You're not a pantser. I love it.
Yeah, I mean, the yeah, thing I'm really curious about, you know, if I can ask Elizabeth a question, you know, even before you had my roadmap of where I wanted this thing to go, like, is this pretty much the trilogy that you were expecting when you approached me about writing, hey, want to do a pilot trilogy? Like, is this roughly what you were looking for at the time?
This is so sinister. We're revealing Elizabeth's secret agenda here to just get these.
I mean, from a I have a twofold answer. From a plot perspective, Yes, I think so. Definitely. We're going to have this crew of misfit pilots, and we're going to be able to dig into the Imperial Remnant a little bit. And book three will have some relationship to the Battle of Jakku and the end of the war. Absolutely. In terms of who these characters ended up being, their journeys, and the way that it has made me rethink the role of redemption in the Star Wars galaxy. No, I didn't plan that part. That was pretty good.
Elizabeth, did Alex Davis do the summary again?
Oh, of course he did. He's okay. The king of copy.
He's, I went back and listened to our chat last time, and we were talking about how, you know, he should have won awards just for that summary, and it was so, it was so great. And this one is equally good, but it's very long, so I don't want to read it necessarily, but it is really great, and anyone can just look online and read the summary. It is fantastic. Alex really, yeah, he does great work there. So I'm gonna do the one obligatory question here, Alex. If you can give me your elevator a version of Victory's Price.
It's the ending.
God damn you.
This is the book in which, you know, everything gets set on fire, in which, you know, our scrappy team of Republic heroes goes up against their Imperial counterparts one last time, only now their personal stakes are significantly higher because they know these people. They know them as individuals. And also the galactic stakes are much higher. The you know, planets are being burnt down. The war is coming to an end. And yeah, it's the culmination of everything that we've set up in two books prior.
Well, during our last conversation, we talked about sort of what can we expect from book three, right? We were talking about book two at the time, and of course, in a non-spoiler fashion, you sort of laid it out like this, and I wrote it down because I thought it was great. So you said in book one is the techno thriller, the Tom Clancy, crazy stuff going on, high stakes, individual missions. So check. Book two, you called it a full-on war novel, although yes, but I would probably go a lot further than just that. And then for book three, you said at the time, space opera, big emotions match perfectly with big conflicts, and where, and this is the line that Elizabeth and I both loved very much, where everything erupts in fire. So you kind of just said the same thing just right there. So that's, I think you, yeah, I mean, the way you just, that's a great summary too, right there. It is all those things. And you know, I was thinking about it, you know, I actually think this third book is the most surprisingly, because, and surprisingly only because the first two are I think are so high level, but this one to me is the most cinematic in a lot of ways. Mm. I don't know if you could make Shadowfall into a film, because there's some weird shit that goes on, especially in the second act, that I'm not necessarily sure it would translate. You know, it depends on the filmmaker, I guess. But I think you could make Victory's Price into a film, and I think it would probably be the greatest movie of all time.
Because I cannot recommend highly enough. I often listen to the Battlestar Galactica soundtrack while, right, I've been editing Alphabet Squadron, and it goes so perfectly.
Right. That makes sense. Absolutely. So, you know, is that just come naturally, Alex? I mean, you just seem to write space opera, you know, so well. I mean, like, everything does erupt in fire, but like in this beautiful, like, poetic way. I mean, it's really quite a thing.
I mean, space opera is the natural mode of Star Wars.
Sure, sure.
So, you know, to a certain extent, figuring out how to do Star Wars as a techno thriller or a war novel is the challenging part. Mm. And then you just let it slide into space opera.
Right.
So, yeah, getting that tone, that approach for Victory's Price was probably one of the simpler things about that novel, because, you know, with all of the setup from the previous two books, I could take off all of the breaks and just let it become as Star Warsy as it needed to be.
Right, which is funny actually too, because, you know, one of the things that I really liked a lot about this book, and Elizabeth, this is probably more for you. You know, one of the compliments I can give Alex is that he somehow writes Star Wars without it feeling contrived in any way. Like, I feel like you could replace every Star Wars axiom and bit of vernacular and it would still be a fantastic story. Elizabeth, how difficult a proposition is that over the course of three long books in a portion of the timeline that is like bookended by massive huge Star Wars moments and the big saga names are still around?
Yeah. I mean, they kind of get to that fundamental question of what makes a story a Star Wars story.
Sure.
And when you can't, or it wouldn't be appropriate for the story to have like the iconic characters of Han, Luke, Leia, Vader, in a story, that what do you play on that really still gives it that feel? And I think there's the obviously the plot trappings of X-Wing pilots and struggle of good versus evil. But I really go back to what I was kind of joking about earlier, but that idea of redemption is so core to the identity of Star Wars. And I think this trilogy re-examines the idea of redemption in such a multifaceted way that both feel so Star Wars, but also now adds to my understanding and love of Star Wars as redemption is depicted in the films.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if I can add something there.
Yeah,
I
mean, of course.
That's a great sort of high level thematic way of looking at it. I will also say on the much more sort of ground level, you know, nuts and bolts level, you know, this trilogy could not have functioned anywhere like it is without the character of Hera.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Because Hera is...
Who I was going to bring up, but yeah.
Okay.
No, yeah. No, keep Hera, going. Yeah, yeah.
Hera is this touchstone of Star Warsiness within it all. Not just because, you know, one, she's a recognizable character, but the kind of character who she is also embodies all of the things that we think of as most Star Wars-y, right? She is a character who, you know, is kind of family-oriented in the way that all of the original trilogy characters are, both literal and sort of metaphorical characters. She is, you know, sort of pure of heart in the way that all of our original trilogy heroes are, right? Like, she has the continuity ties, but she is also the spirit of Star Wars embodied in this character. And by keeping her around, she sheds a certain light on everything else in the books to make sure that all of it exists in reference to this pure core of Star Warsiness.
Well, again, it's my opinion. I think you do more than just keep her around. I actually think this is the best Harrison Dula we've ever seen, to be honest with you. Who I still think is horrifically underappreciated in all of Star Wars, by the way. I'm a big fan of hers, and I really would love to see, but I don't want to see too much because then we're going to ruin her, right? Kind of like, we got just enough. But Hera's like a lot of characters in this book too, right? Where they're just tired. Right? They're tired of war. You know, they've lost count of the wins and losses, especially Hera, who's been doing this for so long. And she's got, you know, Hera in this book has got one eye sort of on the future, you know, part of which is, of course, being reunited with her son, Jason. But she believes in democracy. She believes in all that great stuff. So she's not a quitter, right? She's a fighter, and fighters fight. But talk about that sort of with Hera, because there's so much you sort of hint at. There's things she needs to do after the war, but you know, this Hera is she's worn down, isn't she? Like she shows it, like she's frustrated a lot. She lets her emotions out a little bit more than she normally does in front of other people, right?
She's ready for the war to be over, right? As really most of the characters are,
right?
You know, I liked the notion that, you know, same as it is for really much of the audience, that you see the Battle of Endor, you see the Emperor die, and it's like, okay, it's over. And then it's not. It just keeps going. And, you know, Hera, for, you know, those first few months, she's you know, everyone's still buoyed by the sense of victory, and then it just keeps dragging on, and she, you know, she certainly believes in everything she's doing, but she's getting, yeah, she's getting a little bit tired, and, you know, she's been dreaming for years and years and years of what, you know, life is going to be like without the Empire, and that keeps getting pushed a little bit farther down the line, and that's starting to get to her. And of course, you know, she never wanted to be a general either, right? That's right. She's very good at it. But she's operating in a mode that is all of the responsibility and none of the fun of being, you know, a space.
That's Elizabeth's job, isn't it?
Oh, it's plenty fun.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, that's so interesting you say that. And I feel like I love the title Victory's Price, and I love how we see that consequence for each of the characters, but especially for Hera, it's just the theft of time for her, of these years with her son that she is never going to get back. And it's a sacrifice she made, and she would make it all over again, but it's also just so unfair.
Hera, it really makes me think of Elizabeth. That sounded wrong. When I think of Hera, I think of Elizabeth. Don't you guys?
I'll take that any day of the week.
So this trilogy is squeezed into a very delicate part of the timeline. I mean, besides, it's got to be precise and entertaining, of course, but it's got to be accountable, right, Elizabeth? So a character like Hera, we got to make sure, you know, their part in this timeline is accounted for. And is that sort of, was that where you come into play with a lot of the stuff? Because this cast is big, and it got bigger in this book.
Sure. I mean, you mean in terms of making sure it fits into all the other storytelling that she needs to participate in?
And let's just say Alex maybe had some tequila one night and emailed you and be like, hey, I have an idea. I'm going to kill Hera. And you're like,
unfortunately, that's never happened. Now I'm just sad. Like, please send me more drunken emails, Alex. But I thought that was much less of a struggle. This actually would be interesting. I'd love to hear you talk about Alex. Squadrons was not out by the time we were talking during Shadowfall's release, and I know that you have really thoughtfully kind of woven details from that game in throughout the entire trilogy, because this is happening so hand in glove, especially for Hera's events. If you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's coordinating that sort of thing is always, always tricky, and you know, I think I don't know where exactly I learned it. It may have partly been in the video game world. One of the tricks that you learn is to write stories in such a way that if, say, a large other part of the story suddenly needs to change, you can preserve the bits that that you've established already. And I think one of the ways that I had to approach tying into the other, stuff like Squadrons was going, okay, what can I touch on that I know is going to be in there? And what do I not want to talk about because it could potentially change, because I don't want to box them in any way? And yeah, making sure all of that was categorized properly. And it also helped tremendously the story group was great in terms of getting us documentation and, you know, keeping all that in line. But also I happen to have worked for many years at BioWare with one of the writers on Squadrons. So we had a level of trust, and we could, you know, swap emails late at night if something came up. So having that existing working relationship helped a bit as well.
So I think we can all agree endings are hard. I spoke to an author recently of a trilogy who had actually, the idea for the trilogy, she came up with the ending first, worked her way backwards. Because I don't think you work like that, but if you do, please correct me. You know, the idea of specifically how it ended, and not, please don't get into specifics or spoilers, but when did the ending sort of come to you, and or did it just sort of appear organically, like naturally, just as you were going through the process?
Well, I mean, we were talking about that original sort of 3-page outline earlier, right. And that kind of covered the big sweeping, like, okay, here are the stakes. I believe that document even had a fairly clear, like, all right, this is what Quell goes through, and this is where she ends. Some of the other characters were less specific, but that was, I can't conceive of a story that I feel comfortable starting to write without knowing where it's going to go.
Okay. And Elizabeth, did you, other than, hey man, try not to kill everyone, did you have any notes for the ending, or you just said, hey, no, just you liked his original outline ending, and you trusted him enough that you knew it was going to work out?
Oh, I mean, I also looked through some old notes in preparation for this call, and I think, like we alluded to, there's some character fates that, yep, definitely had some changes. But for the most part, I have typed over and over in emails of, like, this is my thought, this is your book, and as you're writing, feel it out, and if it feels right, then I'm on board.
Right.
I want to go on the record. I want to go on the record that I did agitate for more hugging in this book, and Alex and Jen Heddle shut me down, and yeah, okay, they were totally right, I guess, you know, but I just wanted more hugs. So there's my big editorial note.
You voted for more hugs, but you also argued for more violent death.
Okay, you're not wrong.
While hugging is what she meant. Oh, God, it's so simple.
That's how the boa constrictor scene got in there. Oh. It doesn't really fit, but it made my editor happy.
This is a backdoor Anaconda 3 script. Yeah, yeah. I guess it's not a spoiler to say, but not a lot of hugs, not a lot of hugging. A little bit, not a lot. But, you know, to that point, too, sort of like the emotion of the story is I mean, obviously we're invested with these characters, so it doesn't take much to make me cry at this point. But, you know, after you ruthlessly killed Ito and Siren last book, Alex, which I still haven't forgiven you for, I didn't think I had anything left. But, you know, you somehow were able to, I welled up a couple times during this book, and oddly enough, it actually one time had to do with those two characters. So one of the things I loved about this book was you didn't forget about anybody or anything in the previous two books. Like, I don't know if I have any questions. you know what I mean? Like, as far as, well, what happened to this person or this moment in Alphabet Squadron, or what happened to this person in Shadow Fall? Like, I mean, there's a couple of things, obviously, that are, you know, are yet to be, you know, decided or put into a story by Lucasfilm down the road. But, you know, you were really accountable to both previous books in such a great way. Is that just, again, something that just naturally sort of came out of you, or you're like, okay, I started this thread, I pulled this thread, you know, way back then, I got to make sure that I finish that?
No, it's a good question. I think it's a mix of both. You know, and this actually goes back as well to, you know, we're talking about, like, you know, are we mourning these books? And having said everything I needed to say about these characters also helps in terms of the closure.
Right.
I think for the major characters, it was intended going in. There are a lot of minor points where, if this had been, not that it would have made any sense, but if this had been, you know, a standalone book without prior books that it was building on, I would have brought in new plot elements, new characters, because some subplot needed them. Whereas in this, I had two books of previous stuff to draw on, and just in terms of conservation of plot points and characters and keeping it all as tight as possible, it would make sense to bring back an old character and go like, oh, I don't need to make up something new here. I've actually got someone back from book one who will work really nicely for this. Let's bring them in. It'll be nice to conclude their story as well. It, you know, keeps the plot a little simpler. So there were both sort of planned artistic reasons and also just practical ones.
Right. And Elizabeth, like, I think this book is like a masterclass in introducing new characters this late in the game, who have just enough impact, but again, don't, you know, take the spotlight away, right, from the people that we've been bled with so far. Did you have any influence in that at all? Or is just more of Alex being awesome? Like, what was the idea there? Because there's a lot of new characters in this book.
Oh no, Alex is just awesome.
Okay.
He just does perfect drafts. And then I say, hey, printer, now make this a book. And that's basically all I do.
Because I started typing out like all the new characters that are in this book and I just got tired and I stopped. So there's a lot. And like, listen, some are only in it for, you know, one mention. Some are in it, you know, for lengthier missions or something. But there's a lot.
Well, but I think that's also... it speaks to the themes of the trilogy as well. Just this constant churn of pilots needed to added to the fight because it isn't over yet. So it's
a lot of recruiting on both sides at this point.
Exactly.
Yeah, a lot of recruiting. One of the things I really, really, and this is, and you know, Alex, if you remember at all, my expressed to you my fondness for droids and. You know, there's in the second act of this book, we visit a fueling outpost, which has experienced a bit of a droid revolution. And, you know, besides being a dream come true for like L3, L37 and N3RO, this just talk about sort of how you conceive of this idea of a planet. And don't talk about why we're at this outpost, right, obviously. But, you know, this idea of this droid, you know, revolution on this small outpost is such a great idea. And I know it's, you know, you spend so much time involving droids in your story.
Yeah. I mean, to a certain extent,
it just seemed like a lot of fun. It seemed like a really fun idea for you. Cause I enjoy the hell out of it. And there's a great conversation that takes place on this outpost between two people. And it's just like, I got like the hairs stood up because any talk about droids and artificial intelligence and sentience is like right up my alley. That's why Ito is one of my favorite characters.
I mean, it was absolutely a ton of fun.
Yeah.
And to an extent, you know, it was scenery. I think you could have written a version of this book and concocted something that would still have worked without those, you know, you would.
Oh yeah, for sure. Oh yeah. Not yeah.
But they're not so intimately tied into the themes and plot points of the book that it couldn't have worked without them, but it was fun. And one of the things that, you know, I really wanted to do with this trilogy because of the time period in which it's set, I sort of set myself a goal at the beginning and hopefully sometimes succeeded, which was I never wanted to sort of go to a scene or a location that felt like it could have existed during the original trilogy time period, right? Everything had to have some sort of difference with the Empire having fallen. It could be an evolved version of, you know, what we've seen in the past, but it shouldn't be identical. We should be seeing all of the little things that the fall of the Empire has caused. And yeah, the droid outpost was very much sort of a product of that. And a couple of sort of plot expediency questions where it sort of all came together and it was like, oh, I can do an outpost full of horrible revolutionary droids. I think it's probably more L3's nightmare than L3's
dream. Well, I don't know. I don't know. I think she'd be into it.
She might.
And N3RO too, from the Freemakers. I don't know if you guys have ever seen the Freemaker. You know, the maker of Zoe episode when they visit that planet, and you know, he's N3RO, I'm telling you, this is his this is his Sybarite. There is one line too. It goes, oh, they do get a bit obsessive, and that won't make sense to anybody unless you've read the book, so that's not a spoiler, but that is like a chef's kiss line for a particular person, and I just, Alex, I wanted to thank you for that line. I love it so much. Elizabeth, one of the things we get to do in this book, which Alex does, is we get to take a look at Coruscant at this point in the timeline, which we haven't seen a lot of up until now. Turns out it's not a great place anymore. Not a fun place. What was your sort of, you know, when you first saw that on paper that we were going to take a look at Coruscant?
I think we get a few interludes in Life, Debt, and Empire's End.
Right.
But for the most part, no, we haven't been able to see Coruscant. So yeah, I was really excited that we get to go to such an iconic location for Star Wars in this final book.
And there is another moment in this book, you know, speaking of iconic, and I'm not going to say what it is, but hopefully you're picking up what I'm putting down, Elizabeth. Involves, you know, a couple of the saga's most important people, but when you first saw that part, how did that, you know, were you shock and awe? Were, you know, what was your feeling on that, if you kind of know the one I'm talking about?
Yes. That I honestly, I'm genuinely shocked and pleased that it got to still be in there. Because that's, like, you know, understandably Lucasfilm is protective of those characters in such a huge moment like that. But being able to turn that camera around and see such a unique perspective and such a different emotional take on that scene.
Incredibly really different, right? I think we are allowed to say that Will Lark witnesses something that, you know, profoundly affected him in a big way. And Alex, I don't know if you're able to talk about it without revealing what it is, just sort of where the idea came from.
Yeah, I mean, that was in my head from book one. There are some very, very minor hints about that. I think they, and maybe they're so minor that I couldn't even find them myself anymore. But yeah, I had that in mind. And it is, and I think it's fair to say that it is a misinterpretation of some stuff by Will, but a very understandable one, and one that is not without some merit despite its wrongness.
Mm-hmm.
That it's you know, I was talking about having Hera in there as a Star Wars touchstone, and there are other times that you kind of want to go, okay, let's link this back to the core material and see what the themes that we've been exploring, how that reflects on that original material, how that reflects back, consider the perspectives that we're getting and what the amount of context that we get in certain situations means for how we interpret events.
Right. And I really love sort of like this story is kind of like an outlier story, right? Like, you know, even in the third act, like they're part of the Jakku fight, but not like the main part. You know what I mean? It's a footnote almost in a lot of ways. But at the same time, I wouldn't want you to ignore the fact of what else is going on, right? At that particular time in the timeline, which again, we talked about earlier, is a very important part of the timeline. There's a lot of crazy shit going on. So, you know, I really love the balance that you make with that, with, you know, giving us this story in as much detail as you did, but at the same time, once in a while reminding us where we are in the timeline. One of the great things, Alex, that I think you did was, you know, you don't have to do a ton of world building. Obviously, it already exists. Most of it does. And one of the things that I really loved that you do in the thank you notes here is that you thank Michael Stackpole and Aaron Alston. You know, for if anyone out there who doesn't know, I can't imagine why you wouldn't. They're the architects of the original X-Wing novels that influenced many. Talk about sort of that, having that base to work from. And this is not to say you didn't steal anything from them, but, you know, you mentioned them specifically, right, in your thank you note. So just talk about sort of that influence.
Yeah, I mean, that's one where, so I am not intimately familiar with the Stackpole and Alston novels. But I was also very, very aware that that was the legacy that allowed these books to be possible. You know, when you look at sort of the history of Star Wars publishing, I don't know if the X-Wing novels were the very first. I suspect not, but they were certainly the first big successful set of novels that wasn't about known characters, right? Like they not only set the precedent for sort of Star Wars military fiction, but also, hey, we can do a bunch of characters in the shadows of, you know, the film characters, the films themselves, and find an audience for them. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the, if I had had more time, I would have sat down and like binge all 10 of those novels before figuring out the plot for Alphabet Squadron. And I instead avoided that because I was afraid that I would end up taking too much from them being back to back like that. But you know, even then, like I certainly, you know, went through and I referenced them, and you know, I've referenced them in the past with other Star Wars works, and yeah, I mean, they built the blueprint that I'm working on.
You're dogfighting action scenes, I think, are so beautiful and technical and just flow so great. Elizabeth, how is it to edit those scenes? Do they need any editing? Because I mean, the third act, there's sort of like a Return of the Jedi third act where there's three things going on in three different places, but it not once did I feel like I never lost track of where I was, who was doing what, and there's some like, you know, bananas stuff going on, right? Like there is some crazy shit going on, and like a lot of it, and you know, I know we've talked about how clean a writer he is. Was that the case even in this third act and stuff like that? Because, you know, I think you'll admit, like, the third act of this is pretty wild.
Oh, my, yeah. The multiple locations, so many characters. Yeah. It's amazing stuff. No, it is absolutely clean. And I think that's a twofold situation. A, that, you know, Alex is just an incredibly amazing, talented writer, and I can't say that enough times. but also, I feel like he also specifically... the way those dogfights are written, that they emphasize the emotional through line of all the characters, is not only a great way to keep things straight, but also just plays to my personal tastes. I think that is such an important way to keep people engaged with the stakes of the fight, rather than getting wrapped up in the minutia of exactly where plane A is moving to attack plane B in a way that is hard to describe. It. That's not cinema.
Right.
I also want to add, in the original outline, and I'm so glad that you caught it in the outline stage rather than the manuscript stage. You had a note in there that was absolutely right, but made coordinating those final scenes, you know, the sort of simultaneous action in multiple places, even more complicated. You had wanted basically more interaction between those sequences, which forced me not only to figure out how to do that, but also to make sure that the chronology lined up in a satisfying way. So, yeah, I mean, it was absolutely a place where, you know, it made my life so much harder, but it made the book much better, and I am grateful for that.
Well, you know, you've hurt me so much. Anyway, I can return the favor.
Alex, do you think you take Star Wars too seriously? Like, this is not to say you don't have a sense of humor, and the books have moments of levity for sure, and plot derivative sort of like knee slapper type moments for sure. But I mean, in this book, after only one chapter, you see our cast is dealing with some pretty serious shit. I mean, and again, you know, standing ovation for the chapter titles, actually, my two favorites are back to back. I'll even say them: the amoral prioritization of objectives and elimination of inconvenience variables, like Chef's Kiss. I love those chapter titles. But even the chapter titles are critical and compulsive in a way. I remember going to see when the re-releases came out in theater, right? The original trilogy. And, you know, I was an adult at that point. And, well, adult's a loose term, but kids in the theater were laughing at C-3PO, right? Because when he was being C-3PO. And I would like, look, I'd be like, what are you laughing at? Like, he's seriously uncomfortable right now. He's not making a joke. Do you see comedy in Star Wars at all? Or is it dire to you? Like, what's your worldview on it?
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting question, and I'm going to give kind of a long and rambling answer from a couple of different angles.
Because I definitely take it too seriously. It's just like, there's no doubt about it, right? For sure I do, yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, for starters, I think one of the really nice things about Star Wars as a franchise is that there is enough material coming out that you can have fairly different tones in different works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I feel like, yes, the Alphabet Squadron books probably push about as far from central Star Wars core, average, whatever you want to call it, as you can get, while hopefully still staying within the, yeah, this is Star Wars. You wouldn't want to go much farther than this. But this is a kind of Star Wars, and it still feels like it's within that world. I also think, you know, part of it is certainly just my particular predilections, and also my interests when writing prose. You know, I find it hard to write a novel that is sort of steeped in the war side of Star Wars. And I feel like if you're going to write a series about starfighter pilots, then you're in the thick of the war. That is your focus. My interest when writing prose is getting inside the heads of characters, because I can do that in a book in a way that I can't in a comic or a video game.
Right.
And the emotional toll of that war just has to be apparent. That has to be something that's going to be louder than a lot of the other stuff going on. Right. And then finally, I'm not that great at writing funny things. The only time that I can think of where I've actively been told, yeah, make this funny, it was a joy to write, was the Star Wars Uprising mobile game.
Okay.
Which was the sort of wacky adventures of a sort of smuggler character. Mm. And that was a wonderful challenge for me. I really enjoyed doing it, but it's not my instinctive approach to writing.
Well, I laughed a couple times, so I would maybe I would disagree, especially on the droid planet. There's a couple of lines where I laughed out loud, but Elizabeth, I don't know about you, but Alex definitely writes charming very well. And as the series went on, I'll be damned if Soran Keyes didn't become one of my favorite characters. Like, he's up there for me. How are you feeling about Soran Keyes? Bad guy's a loose term, right, in this series for sure, right? It's complicated, but every good, you know, story needs a villain, I guess. How are you feeling about Soran Keyes as this thing went on? Because he's emerged as, you know, such a top tier character.
Yeah. Oh, okay. This is, I'm going to watch my words here.
Yeah, it's going to be tricky for a crazy person, his motivations in this book in particular, as it relates to like the MacGuffin of the story, right, are quite lucid.
Yeah, right? Well, I think, yeah. I mean, he's just exactly the right villain for this group of heroes, right? He is sympathetic, and you understand exactly why he is doing the things he's doing. But I love that the book never lets him off the hook for the responsibility that these sympathetic motivations still are resulting in unconscionable actions.
Right. What I like about him is, and to your point, he doesn't even really let himself off the hook, does he? Like, it's, he kind of knows what he's doing and what the likely outcome is going to be. And Alex, is that sort of what, you know, the idea was with him, that he's got this idea in his head and he's going to see it through. But like I said, in a weird way, there's kind of a lot of, there's some honor there, right?
Well, there was, you know, this is not all of him, but I think it's an important part. And I think I can say this without spoilers, because we do see it in him in Shadowfall. He is kind of the dark side of the sort of military camaraderie, loyalty to your brothers in arms. You know, he embraces that notion, but it takes him to some very bad places.
Right.
And I think one of the things that the trilogy sort of does a lot of in general is looking at military virtues, and seeing how they are expressed in different contexts, when they cease to be virtues, you know, at what point in a war do they cease to be useful or become increasingly important, right? Because wars change. You know, the end of a war is different than the beginning of a war. Wars under different kinds of governments look very different. And yeah, I mean, Twilight Company explored the notion of the sort of soldierly camaraderie in a more straightforward way to an extent, right? Like that was something that the main character of that novel embraced, and it made the world better, I think, to a large extent. And then, yeah, you can debate how much merit Soren's embrace of that particular kind of honor actually had in the end.
Mm-hmm. Last time we spoke, in, you know, a few minutes left here, we're talking about the messenger, and you said things like, you know, exorbitant evil and utilitarian plot significance, and you know, were of course 100% true. You know, what you were able to do with the messenger in this book especially is, you know, sort of like you've lifted the veil, you know, in a lot of ways. As a plot device, you know, when did sort of you come up with this idea? Again, please try not to reveal anything if you can help it, but as a plot device, was this in it from day one, or is this something that came later on?
I'm pretty sure it was in it from day one. I can't remember in detail. I believe the general function was planned from day one. The specifics, maybe not, but the I am going to use this instrument to get where I need to, and knowing kind of roughly where I needed to get, that was in there. He's just been patiently hanging around for two books to find purpose.
Right. Yeah. Just literally. Yeah. Hanging around, hovering. Yeah. Elizabeth, was there anything in this trilogy that Alex wanted to do that you sort of had to pull rank on, or no?
Interesting. I really don't think so, because I didn't pull rank on the hugs, and now I regret it. Now that I'm talking about it, like, every chapter ends with a hug. Come on. No, I really don't think so. Okay. I think, you know, there were definitely a few things that we had some back and forth collaboration on, I think, but,
because there's one character in particular where we don't, you know, we don't learn everything,
and it's perfect.
And it's, and it's painful, not perfect.
Why not both?
Both. It is. There's your jacket quote right there. It's perfect and painful. Alphabet Squadron. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so nothing major, anyways.
Yeah, I don't think so.
That the company said no. Well, we got other designs for that person or whatever.
No, I mean that's the lovely freedom of having mostly original character cast.
Sure. True. True.
That you can be the masters of their fates.
Get you out of here both on this question, and please correct me if I'm wrong. Alex, is this your first trilogy for both of you, or?
Yes, this is my first trilogy.
Elizabeth, have you edited a trilogy from start to finish before?
Actually, now that you say that, no, because I did not edit Aftermath.
Right. I think I remember that. I think I might have even asked you that last time, the first time we spoke. So, I mean, I don't know if it's any different or not. This is because you're the professionals. You tell me. Did you enjoy the trilogy experience? Would you do it again? Is it, you think it pretty good experience overall? And besides just the fact that you two obviously work together so well.
I mean, I love working with a big canvas. Mm. And I also have a love for sort of serialized storytelling. So yeah, no, I really enjoyed working at this scale.
Like Alex, do you ever think you'll ever be any good at writing one book again? Like, do you think, you know, because like, you know, you like you said, if you enjoy and excel at such a large canvas, I would think it would be difficult then to go back to, you know, a single novel.
I mean,
or is that just what makes you a professional writer and me talking to professional writers?
No, I mean, it's a reasonable question. Like I think, so I started, you know, I learned to write writing short stories. Mm-hmm. So I think there's enough sense ingrained in the back of my brain of, okay, here's what you can do with X amount of space. Mm-hmm. That I should be able to shift back, but who knows? Like I haven't started a standalone novel since wrapping up Victory's Price. So it might turn out very badly next time around.
Elizabeth, I guess your first full start to finish trilogy was a good experience?
Oh, loved it, absolutely. I mean, if you were asking me, you know, for a desert island, you can only take movies or TV shows. I'm a TV show person. I love long form serialized storytelling, and you get to do that with this trilogy. Mm-hmm. Looking back to Alphabet Squadron, and as much as I love that book, if that was the only time we ever got with those characters compared to how much more we know them by the time you reach the end of Victory's Price, it would just be a sadder world without that.
Well, depending on who lives or dies in Victory's Price, which we're not saying who, they are all top to bottom wonderful characters, Alex, and you have no idea over the years how many times I've gone back and forth on who's my favorite. it's changed. It's stayed the same. It's just been nuts. But you know, like some of these characters in particular, Kairos and Yurka are with me for life. There's no doubt about it. And poor Ito. But I can't thank you enough for this trilogy. I'm such a huge fan. I'm a life is too short for bullshit person. So when I say it's my favorite trilogy of all time, I mean it. So Elizabeth, same to you. Thank you for the work you did. I absolutely adore these books and these characters so much, and I just think the world of the job you guys did on it. So thank you so much for coming on the show. When the show releases, the book will have been released already, so please go out there and buy it. Star Wars is off to a great start this year with the High Republic and everything else, so let's keep it going. So everyone get out there, buy this book. Alex, Elizabeth, thank you so much, and enjoy the rest of your day.
There you have it, another episode of Everything is Canon all wrapped up. Huge thanks to both Alexander and Elizabeth for taking the time to speak with me. It's been a lot of fun following this trilogy the last few years, and it's definitely a happy, sad type of situation now that it's over. But I have no doubt Alex will be back in the Star Wars family before you know it, if he should choose to be. In the meantime, Star Wars Victory's Price is on sale now, and it's never too late, of course, to pick up the entire trilogy if you haven't yet. I highly encourage you to do just that. As always, be sure to subscribe to the podcast wherever you choose to listen, and head on over to cinelinks.com for the latest TV, movie, books, and gaming news. Please continue to be safe out there. Bye for now.